Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning to the person I refer to as the voice, not the television show. Good morning, everyone. This is Jeffrey Swartz. I am a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School, Tampa Bay campus. I'm here together with my compatriot, Brendan Berry, who just by happenstance, happens to be also a professor of law at WMU Cooley Law School's Tampa Bay campus. This is the Constitution Today. And, of course, I have to do my little disclaimer at the beginning, and that is simply that the things that Brendan and I say and the opinions we espouse are ours and ours alone, except for the ones that we share. But they are not necessarily the opinions of the administration of WM Cooley Law School or its faculty at large or individually. I'll get to Hezzy in a minute. Good morning, Brendan.
Good morning, Jeff. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
Up in D.C. today, huh?
Yes, I am. This is live from a city called Washington, D.C., and for those of you who went to the public schools, this is our nation's capital. And I'm walking around looking at all the buildings and all the monuments and all kinds of things. Took a little tour of the Capitol yesterday, that whole front area of the Capitol where all the rioters and insurrectionists were, is completely blocked off. They're doing all kinds of repair work to that, so you have to go around the back side to get into the visitors center. Cool. And we walked through yesterday and looked at all of the statues. It was a rather interesting day. I had not been there in a very long time and forgotten about the stuff. And was admiring the statue of Barry Goldwater, of all people, the father of modern conservatism. He has probably the nicest statue in Statuary Hall, under the rotunda. He has a beautiful statue. Makes him look like he could just step right down and be a politician today. I'm serious. I mean, I'm looking at him going, the man who would have taken on JFK. And helped us get rid of Nixon. So he wasn't all bad. But I have to say this, in looking at all that Marilyn made a rather, and I would say good morning to Marilyn, except for she's sitting right next to me right now. Morning, honey.
Hi, Marilyn. Say hi.
Okay. Yeah. Hi from Brendan. Okay. She waves back. Marilyn made a rather interesting observation that as you look back at the pictures that we took, she said the statues that were done of the women who were submitted either by congressional request or that were put in by the states, because the states get to put two statues. In the Capitol, the ones of the women just don't seem to have the gravitas, for lack of a better way to put it, of the statues of the men. They tend to be plain, probably not to the level of the detail that you see in the men. And as I look at it, she was not wrong. They just don't carry it the way that the ones of the men do. So it was just a little observation that was made. The one from Florida can't remember first name. Last name was Bethune, as in Bethune-Cookman Law School, University. The only distinguishing feature of hers, other than it's pure white and it's made from marble, the same marble as was used for the David, by Michelangelo. There's a black rose in her hand, which is how she referred to all of her black students, because it's a traditionally black school. And it stands out because of the black rose. Otherwise, as you look at it, it looks to me almost like an unfinished sculpture. So we just happened to notice. She noticed it and pointed it out to me, and I had to agree that she was right. Mm-hmm. But Barry Goldwater looked like he was just like ready to walk into the Senate. Of course, he was never as thin as the statue makes him look. But, you know, he looked like he was ready to just walk in and take over. It was very interesting. Mm-hmm. So Washington's been fun. What have you been doing with yourself, Brendan, of any great significance?
Yeah, nothing.
Other than changing our curriculum.
Okay. Yeah, details, right.
Okay. We start out each of our shows with a segment that we refer to, What Do You Really Think? And for earlier today when Brendan and I talk, we do talk. There is a conspiracy here. Okay, we get together and agree on stuff, so there's a conspiracy. I was going to talk about the Tennessee legislature thing, but I think that's more a topic mm-hmm. that we should talk about together than individually. And so we'll go to that shortly. But I wanted to talk about a story that I saw on CNN, which was very interesting, very observant. It deals with this murder conviction of a guy by the name of Perry, who was an Uber driver. He's a former sergeant in the Army. And he was an Uber driver a short time ago during a Black Lives Matter protest. And there was a guy named Foster who was walking around with an M16 strapped to his chest. He was on the Black Lives Matter side. But almost like he was protecting them by carrying his M16. Actually, it was what we refer to as an AR-15. And apparently a dispute started between them, and eventually Perry shoots and kills Foster. And Foster was charged with murder. This happened in Austin, by the way. And there was a trial in which Foster claimed stand your ground under the Texas Stand Your Ground law. The jury deliberated for some time, several hours, in trying to determine whether it was stand your ground. They were instructed appropriately on stand your ground, and they found Perry guilty. This is just very recently. He hasn't even been sentenced yet. And apparently, Tucker Carlson picked up on the story and started talking about it, and then basically, face in on the camera, says, is Greg Abbott going to pardon Perry? Or is self-defense dead in the state of Texas? And the next day, Greg Abbott comes out. The guy hasn't even been sentenced yet. Comes out and says, I'm ordering the parole authority, who must review it first, okay, to start immediately. I want to jumpstart this and start immediately on a pardon request for Perry because I want to pardon him before he's even been sentenced. Mm-hmm. Because we have the strongest stand your ground law in the country, and a jury does not have the right to nullify that claim. Now, as I understand it, juries deliberate on the facts, instructed on the law, and make a determination as to whether the facts fit the law or the defense that the defendant wants applied. I thought that's what we do in our criminal justice system. A jury made a decision. And before there's even been a sentencing or an appeal, Abbott wants to be the judge, the prosecutor, and the jury, and make a determination that he's not guilty. He knows nothing about this case. He knows nothing except for Tucker Carlson said to him, you should, Greg Abbott, are you negating self-defense in Texas? Challenging him, saying, I'm going after you on this if you don't do what I tell you to do. Who runs this country? And does Tucker Carlson make policy now? Are people so afraid of him and the MyPillow guy that supports him that Greg Abbott's ready to throw out the jury system, why don't we just have Greg Abbott sit in his office every day, read about a case, talk to Tucker Carlson, and decide to give not guilty verdicts? What happened to our judicial, what happened to our criminal justice system that Greg Abbott has decided he is smarter and better than 12 people who made a decision, a joint decision? Not one person thought this was stand your ground. Out of 12 jurors, which is why we have so many jurors, I just have I'm at a loss, a total and complete loss. This is what happens in totalitarian states. The judge becomes the prosecutor and the judge and makes all the decisions. Okay? And decides. So, you know, Greg, you're already sitting down most of the time anyway. You might as well sit behind a desk and make all the decisions in the criminal justice system when your term ends, because your career is over at that point. I'm sorry. This is just wrong. Let the system play out. And you're telling the people of Austin, Texas, you don't have any right to a jury trial. Just bring it to me and I'll make a decision. This is just wrong. And that's what I really think.
Yeah, there's, there's no part of the American system of government that Republicans are not willing to dispense with at this point. And the answer to your questions, you know, does Tucker Carlson make policy now? Are you really that scared of Tucker Carlson? Of course, the answer to those questions is yes. This is the kind of person. And Tucker Carlson, he's another one of these people. Just on the face of it, is a fraud, and any serious thinking person would say, you know, this has got to be a joke. But yeah, that's who's in charge of the Republican Party, along with Marjorie Taylor Greene and Lauren Boebert and, you know, the Donald Trump and the whole crew. which leads me to something we spoke about earlier this morning, feeling kind of philosophical. By the way, Hezzy, how you doing?
Hezzy.
Oh yeah, I forgot. I forgot about Hezzy. Happy day, Hezzy.
Happy day back.
Yeah,
I'm trolled in this conversation. This is good.
Now I know why I'm not getting the emails. Go ahead.
Yeah. You know, snubbing Hezzy like that. Jeez. You know, but the reason Hezzy came to mind is because, you know, we do, you know, Hezzy asks a lot of questions and makes a lot of points that are quite philosophical. And sometimes I get into this philosophical frame of mind myself. And lately I've been pondering this. You know, one of the things Hezzy talks about a lot and prods us on a lot is, you know, how, because, yeah, Hezzy's got a good heart. He's always kind of probing for, you know, how did we get here and how do we fix it? How do we, you know, because we're in a bad place. You know, when you talk about things, you know, like Governor Abbott and all these people, then Donald Trump and Trumpism and the devolution of the Republican Party and the kind of cruelty and ignorance that defines now an entire political party. You know, and so where are we? I mean, I don't know what we do. I don't know how we start even looking for potential solutions or coping mechanisms or whatever, if we can't sort of be real about the predicament we're in and the problem that we have. And with Jeff earlier, I was talking about that feeling I assume almost all people have had when you come to realize that you're in a relationship that is not salvageable. And again, I know I've had that feeling. I get the sense that Jeff has had that feeling. I imagine, again, most of us have. It's a weird feeling, right? When you, especially when it's a relationship that you have tried to nurture, you've worked very hard to repair, and you come to a point where you say, you know what, this is not going to work. And I feel like we're there as a country. As I said to Jeff earlier, I'm not proposing that the country separates in any literal sense. but we have reached a point, you know, with this Texas judge and the abortion ruling, and again, you know, Donald Trump and Trumpism, and the guns and the religion, you know, being forced on people, you know, of course, a bastardized version of religion, being imposed on the country, and going after gays and, you know, and othering, you know, brown and black people, trying to make it harder to vote. I've to a certain extent lately, pretty resigned. I'm less inclined to really do a deep dive into the news because it's so depressing. I'm just realizing that I'm having that kind of familiar feeling that I haven't had for a while of what, as a nation, where it seems like we're coming to grips with, we have a problem here. We have a relationship amongst ourselves that cannot be repaired and ought not to be repaired. I have told people with whom I was friends since college, which is a very long time ago, that we can no longer be friends because they continue to identify as a Republican. They continue to identify with Trump and Trumpism, and they participated in fostering all of that. In my life, I cannot be a friend with somebody I don't respect. And respect comes, I think, from two components of another person's existence. One is kindness, just somebody who's not cruel, you know, who's not a jerk, someone who cares a little bit about other people, who hurts when other people hurt. That's part of it. And the other part is rigorous thinking. None of us can be right all the time. You know, we're not all, you know, we don't all have an IQ of 160, or, you know, we're not all Einstein. but we can all try. We can all try to understand. We can all ask questions once in a while. We can all subject our own thinking to some probing. We can all consider once in a while changing the way we think and the beliefs that we hold because they're not working and they don't make sense. We can all concern ourselves with what is true and observable. we can all respect expertise and science and facts. And we have a huge segment of the population of the United States that fails on both of those counts. Number one, they are not good people in terms of being kind and caring. They don't care, and they're cruel. And number two, they exercise no intellectual rigor whatsoever. They are willfully ignorant, blissfully ignorant, in many cases downright stupid. and so I've actually had this conversation with former friends. I'm sorry. We had some really good times, you know, sharing laughs at each other's, you know, weddings and, you know, doing all kinds of ridiculous stuff, you know, at our keg parties, you know, back when we were in college. But now, you know, you have persisted in aligning yourself with the kinds of people and the kinds of thinking that I absolutely do not respect. And so what do we do as a country? I don't know. But I think the reality of this is setting in, that this is irreconcilable. And it's dangerous to those of us who don't go along with this. This othering of people, this arming of people, this denial of science. I mean, we're talking life and death stuff here with the guns and ignoring diseases, or claiming that an outbreak of a virus is a political thing, the political scandal of some kind or conspiracy. I'll stop now. Now that I've thoroughly depressed anybody who's maybe listening to this.
I would say this. I think what is missing. Well, there's two things missing, but I'll start with the more philosophical one. I think that the issue is, and you brought up the word respect. Respect for is not just respect because someone agrees with you. Agreeing on all the issues is not the point. I can respect someone's opinion on an issue based upon a known set of real facts, and that their interpretation is different, their direction is different. I can understand that. But it does have to be based upon what I'm going to refer to as a common goal. And in the instance of our country, it is the completion of the promise of our Constitution and respect for the rights of others. If you have that level of respect, and what we disagree on is policy of how the country moves on as a whole, I can respect your opinion. And I can be your friend, and I can have a conversation with you. But when you're thought process is one of destruction, is based upon conspiracy theories or made-up facts, or where you've gotten together in your mind and added two and two and come up with 10 because it fits something for you, and then you move forward from that, and you are... And in reaching that goal, you want to destroy the Constitution and destroy the rights of others or interfere with them, then we don't have a common goal. And thus, because we don't have a common goal and because of the way that you got where you are, then no, I cannot respect that opinion because that opinion is made up. It's not based upon reality. You're trying to create a new reality and calling it your opinion. And that I can't respect. So, and the second part of that is what I've harped on 100 times on this show. And that's the issue of education. And we talked about this, and you even brought it up, and I happen to agree with you. We are at a point where there is one segment of our population and one segment of our society that wants to create a new caste system. And you reduced it down to if you're young and you're beautiful and you're smart, you will succeed in life. But if you are young, or maybe even a little bit older, and you are uneducated because you can't get an education, because you can't afford an education, then you are cast into subservience for what amounts to be a ruling class. That as we destroy the public school system, we destroy the ability of those who we would say pull yourself up by your bootstraps, to be able to pull themselves up by their bootstraps. The rich educate their children, and there is one segment of our society that is destroying the public school system and denying people the education they need to move up. And I've said this before, they don't, those people who cannot move up are frustrated. They are angry. The country doesn't work for them. And they believe that, in fact, there's another segment of society that is holding them back, and they're not wrong. And it comes down, this country was built on public education. People being able to move themselves forward through the education that they receive. We don't do that anymore. And the rich people say, yeah, vouchers, vouchers, vouchers. Taking more and more money from public schools. And I want to destroy the public school system. And I am pointing to the party that is represented by an elephant. And they want to destroy the public school system so people cannot move forward, so they can subjugate those people and tell them, I'm working for you because I'm against the others. It all comes together at that point of education where people aren't capable of knowing facts and reaching their own conclusions. And you know, I can harp on this for an hour. I've done it before. People just don't understand, don't want to understand. I got a voucher. I'm sending my kid to a private school. Yeah. A school where the teacher makes $15,000 a year, hands out A's to anybody, and you think your kid's getting a great education, graduates from high school with a fifth grade education, and can't succeed in anything. While wealthy people take the voucher, add it on, and send their kids to truly outstanding schools so they can succeed and become part of the ruling class. And that's where we are. We are developing a ruling class. And we're almost going back to the jungle. I think what was it called, the jungle by Upton Sinclair? Was it Upton Sinclair? Or Sinclair Lewis? I can't remember which. That wrote The Jungle about the meatpacking industry. And you saw how the ruling class did this. Atlas Shrugged by Ayn Rand. About a ruling class of people. And everybody else works for them. And I think that's what leads you to your frustration. They're not educated enough to make a decision, and you just, and even your educated friends are de-educating themselves out of their selfishness. That's kind of the way I see it, but it's my comment on that. I want to talk about the Tennessee legislature thing.
Yep.
That's okay with you. Okay. And I want to talk about it. We all know what happened. 65 to 70, 50, 60-year-old, and I'm talking about number, a total of somewhere between 60 and 75, 50 and 60-year-old white privileged men in the Tennessee House of Representatives decided it was time to get rid of two very outspoken, up-and-rising young black legislators who had the nerve and the gall to call them out by demonstrating in the well of the legislature while they were in recess, that everybody's milling around, over the issue of guns in light of the recent shooting in Nashville. And they didn't throw them out because they'd been convicted of a crime, and they didn't throw them out because they showed moral turpitude of some sort. They threw them out because of their decorum, because as soon as they started demonstrating, the Speaker of the House got up there and started banging his gavel to bring them back into session because he wanted to end the demonstration. And it took 15 seconds for them to stop demonstrating. And for that, those two young black legislators and a white woman legislator who's been a pain in the side of everybody in that legislature since she got elected a number of years ago, because former teacher who survived a school shooting. They decided we have to get rid of these people. These people. One of the ringleaders was a guy who actually, while they were debating bringing back the firing squad and the electric chair for death penalty, by the way, the chair has been found to be unconstitutional, but that's okay. We're going to pass it anyway. And during one of the debates, one of those legislators said, we should bring back hanging from a tree. In other words, lynching. And even all the Republicans were aghast at this. And as they moved on to a different bill, the guy says, I want to apologize to everybody about the hanging from the tree. Somebody whispered in his ear, are you out of your freaking mind? So he's one of the leaders, and they decide they got to get rid of these guys. So they put them on trial, basically, for to expel them from the body. And they expel the two young black guys, but they let the white woman stay. They decide not to expel her. I wonder if there was any color issues involved there. I don't know. Kind of. So one of the black men has already been appointed as the interim to replace himself in the legislature, and was nominated by the people who have to make that decision by the person he defeated in the election last November. Okay. I mean, that just shows how unified the people of the city of Nashville are. And he was put back into the legislature yesterday. The other one, I guess, on Wednesday his local people are going to renominate him as an interim to replace himself until there's a special election. What's really important here to me as I look at this, okay, is that this is about the human spirit. And this is what the people of Nashville showed. This is about the spirit for freedom and equality. This is about the spirit to throw off oppression. This is an example of the desperation of those who would promote and continue to try to oppress through their feelings of white privilege. And it's showing, their desperation is showing. Could they have been more blatant in their racism than to throw out two young black legislators and allow the white woman to stay simply because of the color of her skin and then try to justify it some other way? Was this more of taking fire hoses to those who would demonstrate, to those who wish to be heard? The state of Tennessee has all kinds of problems, but all of them are rooted in their bias and their prejudice against others. Davy Crockett would be horrified, even though they want to return to the days of Davy Crockett. I don't know how much more a legislative body can do to send a message. We don't want you here. Go away. We are a white state, and it's never going to change. We are a Christian state. It's never going to change. We are a straight state. It's never going to change. We are as backwards can be. And we like being backwards. You keep moving forward, we're going to move back. That's what I see out of what happened in the Tennessee legislature this week. I can't think of it in any other terms. Brendan? Your turn.
Yeah. I got to point this out
before you start. Okay, I got to point this out. Brendan was thinking about applying for other jobs a while ago. And one of the jobs he was going to apply for was at a law school in Tennessee. And he called one day and he was supposed to go to an interview and he canceled the interview. And I said, why? And he says, because I can't see myself living in the state of Tennessee. Am I wrong about that, Brendan?
Well, yeah, I've decided that I'm happy where I am, job-wise. Not that Florida's a whole lot better. we gotta talk about that.
Well, that's true. That's very true.
It's getting hard. And you know, as you were talking about what happened in Tennessee, and you were talking about, you know, Republicans want to bring back firing squad and the electric chair as means of executing people. I just thought how much that reinforces my earlier point. What kind of a human being would advocate for that? For that kind of torture. That's what I'm saying. These are not good people. These are people with rotten hearts. And again, you know, I say again, I don't know how you reconcile with that kind of evil. It's funny, the projection, too, on the right, you know, they accuse the left of everything that they're actually doing, right, of trying to destroy the country and all of that. But I agree. Republicans are, at this point, they are so off the rails morally that they're losing their political touch as well, which is kind of an interesting development. You know, they've gone from dog whistle to bullhorn. That, you know, there's a famous quote by a political strategist named Lee Atwater, which I won't repeat because it's full of vulgar and extremely offensive language. But Lee Atwater was one of the guys who engineered the victory of George Bush Sr., George H.W. Bush. It was kind of a political dirty trickster. And he, when he didn't realize he was being recorded once in a very frank moment, discussed dog whistle politics and how Republicans have mastered it, right? They don't overtly and explicitly say the N-word or other racist, use other kind of racist language. They use coded language. And in that way, they gave themselves some kind of plausible deniability, right? Well, this is not about race or ethnicity, you know, it's just about something else. They've now, when you look at what they did in Tennessee, you know, it's not that dog whistle anymore. It's not coded anymore. It's right there for everyone to see. It's laid bare. The racism, as you said. And that's why, you know, I keep using this term, call the question. Donald Trump and Donald Trumpism and all of this crew of Republicans that's now in charge of the Republican Party, they're not hiding what they're about. They're not hiding the racism. They're not hiding the cruelty. They're not hiding the ugliness, right? This is a grotesque, the noun, not the adjective. The people associated with this are grotesques, and the party itself is a grotesque. And so now we're faced with the question. I guess it's kind of a two-part question. Number one, are we paying attention? And number two, are the majority of us going to continue to put up with this? I fear the answer to those questions. because it is so in our face at this point. To support the Republican Party at this point is to overtly and explicitly support racism. It's to overtly and explicitly support homophobia and all kinds of other fears of quote unquote the other. In a sense, it's good that they're doing it out in the open so that we can, so that we don't have to, get around their code language. But it now is in the open. So what are we going to do about it as voters is the question. And I fear that in Tennessee, Republicans will continue to support this. The majority of Tennesseans will continue to vote for Republicans, even though it's now explicit. We talked earlier this morning about Ron DeSantis, as long as we're talking about Tennessee and Florida. Ron DeSantis has reached his peak popularity in the state of Florida, has the highest approval rating he's ever had. This despite his war on LGBTQ citizens and people. This despite his war on Disney and his war on books and his war on university professors, right? I mean, all of the things we've talked about. Yeah, yeah.
His war on
history.
Right.
His popularity is going up, not down. So my fear is not just what these people are doing. My fear is that the rest of the population is either not paying attention or is actually going along with this, at least in a number of states. And in the case of Florida, not a small one. So I don't know what's going on, but that's I as you can tell this morning, and probably you've seen a trend, right? I'm getting more and more
pessimistic. You're a little pessimistic this morning.
Yeah,
I know.
I'm typically kind of an upbeat person, but it's getting it's getting
well. Wrong. Here, let's just keep rolling with it. Okay.
Yeah.
There is a case out of Texas. Most people have heard of of it over the last few days, and an opposing case in the state of Washington, which was a manufactured piece of litigation where three women who were rabidly anti-abortion were recruited by a national anti-abortion organization to move to Amarillo, Texas, where there is one sole federal judge who was appointed, who for whatever the reasons were, was confirmed, even though he was exposed at his confirmation hearings as being rabidly anti-abortion. He actually represented anti-abortion as a lawyer, represented anti-abortion organization and litigated against Roe v. Wade. And so they forum shopped, moving people who would be the plaintiffs to Amarillo, filed a lawsuit in Amarillo to in essence create what Roe v. Wade, what the Dobbs decision specifically didn't want. And that was a national abortion, what's the word I'm looking for? Outlawing of abortion. A ban on abortion nationally by taking away the method by which more than half of pregnancy terminations take place using a two-prong set of drugs called mifepristone. And it's made up of two drugs. One of them can accomplish the task. The second one makes it easier by taking away some of the pain and the discomfort and the length of period of time for the miscarriage to be created. So it's these two drugs, and they went after the one drug, okay, that would make that makes this a preferable way of terminating a pregnancy. And it has been, it was approved by the FDA over 20 years ago. It is safer than taking penicillin. Literally safer than penicillin. More deaths per million. There's 20 for penicillin. There are 2 for mifepristone per million doses. And he decide they file a suit claiming that the FDA approval process was flawed, that the scientists who approved it were wrong. He holds a hearing on a preliminary injunction to stop the FDA approval and say it's flawed, and so therefore it can no longer be dispensed nationwide. And they came into court, and the most telling question was asked by the judge, is there any other precedent, any other case ever in the history of the Food and Drug Administration where a court has interceded and said the FDA is wrong on the science? And even the proponents of this ban of this drug said, no, there's never been such a case. There is no precedent. District court judges don't create precedent. They follow it. And approvals of the FDA have been litigated, and always the FDA wins because they have the authority to do this from Congress. And yet he has decided, in his opinion, that it's flawed, the science is wrong, and he uses things like saying, and these are like buzzwords in his opinion. He says that it's wrong to refer to the unborn human as a fetus, and continues to refer to what every other judge refers to as a fetus, which is a medical term, as the unborn child. And that this drug deprives the unborn human of nutrition and oxygen, whatever. It depletes the ability of the unborn human to survive and tortures the unborn human. And that the woman who goes through this process suffers serious psychological trauma at seeing the image or seeing the reality of its unborn child. Refers to doctors who prescribe this medicine not as OBGYNs treating their patients, but as abortionists. These are buzzword terms of the anti-abortion standing. This is a judge whose child was pictured in his wife's Facebook page wearing a T-shirt that said, "I survived Roe v. Wade," with a caption by his wife that says that her husband loves this T-shirt. This is like putting basically the fact that he is a true believer out there for everyone to see. He took the bench with an agenda. He was put there specifically for this case. It was forum shop to him. He is the Aileen Cannon of abortion cases. And for those of you who don't know, Aileen Cannon was the judge who said that you can file a civil suit to stop a criminal investigation by the FBI. Did it on behalf of Donald Trump. Sat in Fort Pierce, Florida. You might remember her now. Now, there's another case from Washington State who only took jurisdiction over the 21 states who filed the competing case to find that, in fact, everything is okay with mifepristone, And that judge, the day after the first decision I just talked about, decided, no, I'm issuing an injunction that says that the FDA cannot stop the distribution of mifepristone. And as a result of which, we now have 21 states who have a federal order that says it's okay. And the rest of the country, the other, 39 states, are going to be subjected to this decision by this judge in Texas. Now, there are three states whose governors, all women, by the way, have decided it's really important that this drug be made available. And they have bought up, for example, in Massachusetts, they bought a 3-year supply of this so they could distribute it themselves and therefore not be subject to the FDA. They bought it while it was approved, and there's nothing, the federal court can't step in and say, you can't do that. Michigan and Washington State are stocking up and probably will share with other blue states, other states where abortion is okay, and offer to supply some while this battle goes through. There is pending now in the Fifth Circuit a motion for a stay of the Texas judge's order. I have no confidence that this ultra-conservative Fifth Circuit will grant the stay. They should. Legally, they should, but I'm not confident that they will. And so by Friday, this form of termination of pregnancy will be illegal in 39 states. It is part of the goal of a nationwide ban on the voluntary termination of pregnancy. This is really bad stuff. And I think that this is part of your thought process where we're living in a world where the uneducated and the majority, the massive majority of people in this country didn't even want Roe v. Wade set aside. They think this is a personal right that people should maintain. You don't have to agree with it. You may not like it, but the fact of the matter is it's there. And they understand the threat to their personal rights if this one stands, this denial of this right stands. So I just wanted to comment on that. I don't know if you have anything you want to add.
Yeah, I do. First of all, add this to the list of norms and components of our system of government that Republicans are willing to discard if it doesn't suit them. So, and now I'm talking about separation of powers, right? Just throw that on the flaming heap of former norms and protocols in our system. Separation of powers is pretty simple. We got three branches of government, and each one of them is supposed to stay in its lane. It is up to Congress to set policy, right, to make laws. It is the executive's job, as the name suggests, executive, to execute the law, to carry it out. It is the judicial branch's role to interpret and apply the law to discrete cases and controversies, and that's it. What this Texas judge did is such an affront to that most basic foundational principle that it's almost impossible to believe that he did it. But he did. Congress created the FDA. So Congress sets policy. Now, Congress, there's only 535 people, or there's 435, I forget, but there's only, 500-ish people when you count both the House and the Senate in the U.S. Congress, and they're politicians. They're mostly not scientists and experts. So they get to set national policy. But they need this other thing called the executive branch, where the FDA resides, to carry it out, because that's the executive branch is the branch with all the right, the foot soldiers who get the stuff done that Congress wants done. So in this case, Congress created the FDA. Congress empowered it. to set guidelines for approving medications and drugs, for regulating, as the name suggests, food, right? And drugs, keeping us safe in this area. So they set that policy. The FDA went about its business, hiring scientists and experts, right, and creating regulations for approving or not approving and inspecting, you know, food and all this kind of stuff. So you got those two branches doing exactly what they're supposed to do in our system of government. Along comes a judge who, again, is supposed to be simply interpreting and applying the law, and substitute himself for both of the other branches of government. He doesn't like Congress's policy, so he reset the policy himself. He didn't like the way the executive branch was carrying out the policy, so he decided to carry it out in a way more suitable to himself. This, again, it is such an in-your-face violation of separation of powers that you just shake your head and wonder, you know, what will these people not do? What will they not toss aside? What will they not destroy in their effort to gain power and impose their will? And now, and one other thing about abortion, you know, the unborn and all this concern for unborn humans. This alleged concern is not born of any kind of goodwill. We know that. Because these are the same people who want to bring back the firing squad and the electric chair. These are the same people who don't care about educating children. They're the same people who don't care about children being blown away by AR-15s, right? We know that their concern is not for the well-being of humans and for the sanctity of human life. Because if that was their real concern, all of those other policies, their stance on climate change belies it, all of it. Their insistence that gay kids be subjected to something called conversion therapy and taught to hate themselves. These people are not concerned about children. So what is this really about? What is this really about? Forcing pregnant women to carry pregnancies to term and give birth, whether they want to or not. What is this really about, since it's obviously not about concern for human life? I think the answer to that is pretty obvious. So those are my 2 points. Number one, add separation of powers to the list of norms that we've just got, you know, kind of bulldozed right through. And number two, you know, when they talk about abortion that way, one really has to subject that language to some scrutiny and try to figure out what's really going on here.
What's interesting is that part of what you said takes us full circle back to something we talked about before. Part of it could honestly be that they want these children born to be uneducated, to be poor, to be subservient of the lower class in our caste, our newly created caste system. More worker bees. More worker bees to service us. And that could be part of it too. Especially in the instance if they're going to be white babies. More white babies. We need more white babies. We're being outpopulated. All still part of the idea of white privilege. Still realizing, although we haven't reached that point yet, we are only 10 years away from being a minority-majority country. And it scares the hell out of them. There's literally no issue about that. Now, just as a sidelight so people understand why this judge was so wrong. Administrative law was created by Congress to make agencies to help them regulate things that needed to be regulated because Congress can't do it all. those 435 people cannot possibly do everything that needs to be done. So they created what has been referred to as the administrative state, but administrative agencies under many of our cabinet offices. And the FDA is one of them. When they started them, they had to come up with regulations as to how they are to do certain things. Those regulations were subject to hearings and testimony and all kinds of other scrutiny within the agency itself and from people outside of the agency. And every time now that they change a regulation, they have to have those kind of hearings. If, in fact, in what's built into administrative law, which was created by Congress, is that if an agency passes a regulation that Congress doesn't like, they can disapprove it. But if they don't, those regulations carry the weight of statute as if Congress had, in fact, passed it themselves. The big complaint from the right is that Congress can't delegate its authority. Yet, for decades, maybe centuries, because we had administrative agencies before we knew what they were, the courts had said, no, Congress has the right to delegate authority as long as they oversee that authority. And this guy's saying, Congress delegated authority to the FDA and basically attacking the delegation of that authority and saying that, in fact, the FDA did, their regulations are wrong. They did things wrong under even their own regulations. They followed them, but those are wrong. And it's not taking into consideration these are unborn children. They're not fetuses. They're unborn children, which is a religious thing, not a legal thing. When does life begin? You know, it's like Abbott and Costello. I don't know, third base. That's a religious thing. Some believe at conception. Some even say at ejaculation. Science says that the fetus is not sentient for at least 3 months or more. It has no brain. It cannot be a sentient being. Therefore, it is not human. I don't know. You make your decision, but that's not the issue. Do what your religion tells you. Do what your principles tell you, but don't interfere with the religion and principles of others unless they're doing harm to you. And if I'm missing the point, tell me, Brendan. Am I missing the point?
Nope, but we're 4 minutes over. Poor Hezzy.
That's okay. By the way, Hezzy's still there, but Hezzy has to leave at 11:30. So he said we can stay on the air as long as we want and just hang up.
Well...
Did I get that right, Hez?
You got it right. You got it right.
Okay.
I don't know if I could take anymore. Hezzy, have we thoroughly depressed you this morning, Hezzy?
No.
You know, when we started.
So it's brilliant. It's brilliant thinking. It's absolutely stupendous.
I'm encouraged that we even talk about it. Hezzy. What do you think?
I'm encouraged that you're talking about it because I think it's so pertinent. People don't usually use their cerebral capacity as much as you guys do, which is so important.
I think we should take this act on the road.
Absolutely.
What do you think, Brendan?
That's what it is on the road.
I don't know.
We'll go on
a
national lecture tour.
Oh, God.
I think Brendan's worn out.
Yeah, I'm worn out. And my dog is locked up in my bedroom. She's getting mad at me. So,
scratching at the door and destroying your paint. I understand.
Yeah, I can hear her starting to whine in there.
Okay. All right. Well, I okay. Hezzy, you have a wonderful day. I hope all goes well for you.
You too.
Okay, put me on the next email, will you?
Absolutely. My number one issue.
Right.
There you go. Yeah. All right. Brendan, have a great
all
day.
Right.
I'll see you when I get back into town.
You
okay?
as well. Enjoy D.C. All right. Bye-bye,
okay.
Hezzy. We'll
Take
see you next week.
Take
all
care.
Best,
bye-bye,
guys.
Everybody.
Thank you very, very much.
Bye-bye,
my
everybody.
Pleasure. Well, there we have it, folks. None other than WMU Cooley Law School professors Brendan Beery and Jeffrey Schwartz, the best that I've ever bumped into. And we've never met, but their cerebral capacity just exceeds, what one would expect. And it's definitely a learning experience every time they get on, which is on Tuesdays. Every Tuesday, which is always a pleasure, from 10 o'clock on. So that's the story with us today. I've got to head out to the cardiologist. I have an appointment, so that's where I'm going. And so I won't be following through after the two professors. So we'll speak to you tomorrow. All the best, and thanks again for being with us. Goodbye. And let me just see where we are. Okay. Yeah, and I'm going to end the episode now. Take care. Be well. Goodbye.